2071 from 2008, Counterlane Limited versus United States.
Mr. Peacock, good morning to you. Welcome to the court in San Jose. Please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, and begin by apologizing. I pick up a bad head cold in my travels, and I may have a coughing spell, and I hope that...
Well, at least we can hear you very well, so that's a good start.
Thank you.
We'll get you some water.
May it please the court, this is a case in which the court below held that the claims of Park Terrace Limited and Multiple West Limited were foreclosed under the statute of limitations.
And that turns on whether the letter of response from the government agency constituted a breach.
No, Your Honor, I mean, that is one of the arguments. But my principal argument this morning, I mean, we argued that in the brief. But my principal argument this morning is that the letter, which was written, the two letters are the same, one of them is reprinted at page A79, this letter will serve as a request to pay off the remaining mortgage balance from the above referenced property. Please contact me at your earliest convenience to review that what procedures should be followed regarding the payoff of the loan mortgage. Now, clearly the response didn't say go ahead and pay it off and here's what we want to do. But I respectfully submit that under the Supreme Court's decision in Fantoni, the test is whether or not that letter constitutes a tender. And I would respectfully submit that it does not. The court in Fantoni, the United States Supreme Court in Fantoni, when looking at this issue and finding that the statute...
Well, I don't understand why it wouldn't be a tender. The letter says we want to pay early. And the second sentence seems to just request procedural information about who to send the check to.
Well, I don't know...
It's not conditional. It's like we might want to pay early if such and such and such and such, or we're exploring whether we want to pay early. The sentence number one seems to clearly say we do want to pay early, and sentence number two, as I'm translating it, simply says, how do we do so?
I think, Your Honor, that under the accepted definitions of tender, and I quote the Williston on contracts definition in our brief, stating that alternate terms tender is an unconditional offer of payment consistent.
Yeah, that's my whole point. What is conditional about sentence number one?
But it's got to consist of the actual production of a sum not less than the amount due. Or said in another way that
the remaining mortgage balance.
Yeah, remaining mortgage balance.
No, but you got to have a check. There's no check written. There's no money tender. And that's what the accepted meaning of tender is. When I go back, think about my first year in law school, Your Honors, and in contracts, and I remember my law school professor saying, when we discussed how do you tender, he said, you waive the checking under the nose of the recipient.
We all agreed that that's sufficient. Whether it's required under every circumstance may be less clear.
Well, Your Honor...
We all agreed that no check was attached. So if a check being attached is a requirement, then you win on the tender issue. But it's not so clear, at least to me, that given the unconditional nature of the assertion in sentence one, that the absence of a check is fatal.
Well, Your Honor, we respectfully submit that it is. I would like to point to a couple of cases that consider this issue. In a case in the United States District Court for the District of Rhode Island, Butler versus Resident Care Innovation at 241 Bankruptcy 37, 1999 decision. In that case, one of the parties in the bankruptcy action, in an attempt to persuade the bankruptcy court that their tender made the contract non-executory, the court says, in this case, RCI is the argument.
Is this case cited in your brief?
No, Your Honor.
All right. Well, you cite the general counsel. Just a follow-up letter with a full citation.
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, RCI makes the argument...
I have a chance to respond for the government, because this is a little out of order, out of ordinary order, to be bringing up new cases and oral argument that are neither in the opening brief nor the reply brief. But go ahead.
The court says, in this case, RCI makes the argument that delivery of a photocopy of a cashier's check in the amount of the remaining purchase price constitutes a tender. It thus argues that the contracts were not executory and subject to rejection because RCI performed its obligation. This argument is totally unfounded, since it is clear that RCI failed to tender a check that could be cashed.
So the holding of that case is the copy won't do, you need the original attached to the tender.
Yes, and
that principle governs, you win. We certainly have to concede that.
Aren't you taking an inconsistent position from what was alleged in the complaint, however? In other words, in the complaint, the allegation was that but for the government's conduct, plaintiff would have terminated their contract by prepaying their mortgage.
Your Honor, this case was decided on summary judgment, and we had the opportunity of getting the documents and the government documents, and at that point, clearly, there was no tender. And so it may be inconsistent with some allegations in the complaint, but we're at the summary judgment level.
Is it your position there's only one way to tender performance under a contract that requires a demand to be allowed to prepay, and that is to tender a cashier's check?
I think that's the predominant approach.
Predominant, but means there are other ways.
Well, I think then you look at what must the Supreme Court have meant, because the Supreme Court didn't define tender. But
normal contract principles apply.
Yes.
And my question to you is whether or not that is the only means of tender.
Yes, Your Honor. We believe that it is the only way under the facts of this case.
Now, in fact, does it matter here that we have, multiple government agencies? Maybe that if you and I each own a company and I tender a check to you made out in the name of your company, that no one would have any question about whether that's an adequate tender. But is it even clear to whom the balance of the mortgage dollars would have to be made out as the payee? Is it the Farmers Administration? Is it the Treasury of the United States? Who's the payee of the check?
Well, I don't have the mortgage documents in front of you. I think it's the farmers. I think it's the agency. Is the mortgagee of the property?
And the amount was definite and certain at that point, so that the tenderer would know this is the amount I have to offer at this point.
Well, it's certainly calculable. It's certainly calculable
by him or by the government.
Well, I think it's calculable by either side. You might have a disagreement, and then you could. And I think the law there is you've got to tender at least as much. As the other side claims.
What about the government's response? It seemed to me that Judge Miller seems to have treated the government response as saying, hell no, we're not going to let you pay early because we don't care to, so therefore your rights under the original loan agreement, the contract, are just being cast aside. We don't care. But it's hard for me in reading the letters to see that that's really fair interpretation of the letter. It looked like they wanted to change the subject and talk about a renewed arrangement over a longer time period with added monetary incentives, but also added burdens of not being able to charge mortgage rates and so on. So where in the government's response is there language that could be fairly construed as being a rejection of the tender? No, we won't accept your tender.
There is none. And clearly that's a second prong of our argument, which is that the government never rejected the tender, which of course is also a necessary ingredient with respect to the Supreme Court test.
What about the ability of the government agency to accept the tender? Was it precluded by the statutory amendments?
I think they have interpreted that as that. I think that there are some exceptions. If they make a determination, I think under the regulations, that the property is no longer needed for low income, they can accept it. But beyond that, I think that they're...
But under the realistic facts of this time and place, where I take it it's undisputed, there was a continuing need for low income rural housing of the sort involved, that none of those exceptions would apply.
That's correct.
So in that circumstance, should we conclude that the agency was precluded from accepting the tender, and that everybody knew that, and that therefore, even if the tender counted as a tender, the government's letter, however it might have been worded, should be viewed as a rejection, because everyone knew that in the end they were going to have to reject it.
Your Honor, that leads you to our second argument on this issue, which the court below rejected as being the intention was unimportant here. And that really goes to the issue of what was going on here. And what was going on here was that this was a predetermined procedure in order to get an incentive loan. And there was no intention to prepay the loans at that time. What was intended was to get the incentive loans.
Well, what's the evidence of that?
Well, there's an affidavit of Mr. Axelrod in the record.
Is it undisputed by the government that in order to have a discussion about a follow-up so-called incentive loan, you had to first send a pro forma kind of letter saying, I tender payment of the original loan?
Mr. Axelrod's affidavit and testimony was that...
No, I understand.
This is what he
was
told.
He's on your side, right?
Yes.
Okay, well, my question to you was, does the government agree, or do their witnesses agree, that in order to initiate a discussion about a follow-on arrangement, you had to send a tender letter in?
Your Honor, I don't think there's any disagreement on that, and I think the regulation, I think their documents that were produced here support that. And so, again, going back to Francona, was this really an election to treat the repudiation as a breach, or was this only an attempt to get the money that was being offered in the incentive loans? And we respectfully submit the latter, and that's all that was going on. There was no intention here to treat the situation here as an attempt to prepay. In fact, there's a government document in the record here, Your Honor, that says that in determining the amount of the incentive loan, you're not even to consider whether or not the applicant really wants to prepay the loan or not. The government recognized that in some of these instances, people didn't want to prepay the loan. Suppose today I had a property in the program and I could get an incentive loan, but I couldn't refinance the property and pay off the mortgage because of the conditions in the credit markets. I still would write this letter if I were Mr. Axelrod in order to get the incentive loans.
And so is your argument then that this creates a question of fact that we need to...
The second argument, Your Honor, yes, is that either it creates an issue of fact that the court should decide at trial, or the undisputed evidence here is that both sides so clearly understood what was going on that no one would have taken this as an attempt to prepay the loan.
So then are you saying it should have been summary judgment in my favor, and if not, then at least it should have been a trial?
Yes. Well, I mean, we didn't file a motion for summary judgment.
No, I understand that, but your position seems to lead to the conclusion that since nothing is disputed, in your view, that summary judgment was appropriate, but it was just given to the wrong side.
Yes, but at a minimum...
And then your fallback is, at a minimum, there has to be a trial if there are disputes.
Yes, because that would be an issue. Now, I'd like to just, if I may, Your Honor, turn to the second part of this case, which has to do with the question of to what extent did the court error in not allowing us, assuming that court was right on the statute of limitations, not allowing us to proceed on the rights under the incentive loan, which the court held initially. And there's three opinions on this. First opinion says, yes, you can proceed on that, even though she held her out under the statute on the original mortgage loan. Then she wrote, Judge Miller wrote, a second opinion, reversing herself, a 180, holding that we were precluded, saying that the letter, those letters not only triggered the statute of limitations under the original mortgage, but also under the incentive loans. When we pointed out in the Rule 59 motion that she was basically saying to us that we were precluded by a letter for rights in an agreement that didn't exist at the time the agreement was written. She then wrote a third opinion, and I'm not sure what she said in the third opinion, except to say, to deny that she had adjudicated anything under the incentive loans, but leaving very unclear what would be left for us to proceed with.
But you were trying to amend your complaint to broaden its scope.
Your Honor, I think that the complaint...
Just one step at a time. That's what you were trying to do.
Our first position before the court below here is that the complaint did already cover that. Paragraphs 11-2 and 11-4 plead the incentive loans. Paragraph 19 of the complaint refers to all of the agreements, including the incentive loans. And then in paragraph 50, which is the breach of contract claim, it alleges that the result of the repudiation is that each plaintiff is deprived of the right to prepay before the expiration of the 40 or 50 year mortgage term.
And I'm confused. If your original complaint was already broad enough to cover both the original loans and the so-called incentive loans, then there's no need to amend it.
Well, at the
I think your point was that you were wrongly denied the chance to amend it.
Yeah,
which is it?
At the argument, the first argument, the government raised that it wasn't pleaded. We took the position that it was pleaded, but we said if you think it wasn't, then you should give us an opportunity to amend the complaint. We'll make it crystal clear. The court ruled in our favor at that point. I mean, didn't rule on the issue of whether we had raised the issue, went right to the issue and said, you're okay, you can proceed on this. So we're the prevailing party at that point. Then, when we had the second argument, we made the same point to the judge, because at that point we were the prevailing party. And we made the second point, that if you accept the government's position that we haven't pleaded this, we think we have, you should give us an opportunity to amend. And we made that request five times during the course of the proceedings below. Then, out of the blue, the judge did a 180 and then said that she wasn't going to permit us to amend because it would be a complete reformation of the contract.
And did you ever submit an amended complaint?
No, we never had the opportunity, Your Honor.
Did you ever file a motion for leave to submit amendments to the original?
No, we were sandbagged, Your Honor, because we were the prevailing party under the initial decision. So at that point, there was no reason for us to proceed with a motion.
No, of course not. But once the judge indicated that she thought the complaint didn't cover what you wanted it to cover, why wasn't your response to that to simply file a formal motion with an amended complaint attached to either force her to accept it or reject it and thereby have a good issue on appeal?
Because her opinion said that we would not be permitted. She ruled it without a motion that we could not amend. So her second opinion denied us the right to do that. And that, we believe, we submit is contrary to federal law, which allows amendment. We also think she could have deemed the complaint amended because we had argued this and briefed this, and it was clearly an issue that had been litigated in the court below from the very beginning right through to the very end. So she could have done that as well, but she did not. So we believe that she erred there as well.
Now, what precisely is the relief you seek here?
The relief we seek here is a reversal of the decision of the court below dismissing the claim on the statute of limitations and permitting our claims to go forward.
So you would like us to reverse the grant of summary judgment and remand the entire case back to the trial judge?
Yes, sir.
All right, let's hear from the governor. Thank you, sir. Ms. Davidson, I'd like to observe that it's a great pleasure on the part of the courts to see the head of the very large commercial litigation branch in the Department of Justice, which I believe now consists of over 100, maybe over 200 lawyers who you are responsible to supervise, but to nevertheless see the supervisor to come to court more than occasionally and argue a case herself. So our compliments to you and welcome. Good morning. Please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. I'd like to start with the plaintiff's suggestion that this government program was a charade or was acting as a charade. When Congress enacted a LIPA, it was grappling with the very difficult problem of rural housing for poor people. And what Congress did, among many other things, affected these plaintiffs in two ways. First, Congress imposed restrictions upon the right, the contractual right, to prepay loans for subsidized rural housing. Congress did that because it wanted to maintain housing, and if lenders were allowed to prepay their loans, they would exit the program and there would be a decrease in rural housing. So Congress did impose restrictions, not a complete bar, but restrictions upon the right to prepay loans. At the same time, Congress recognized that those restrictions would cause an economic harm to the borrowers and would force them to stay in the program if they wished to exit. Therefore, Congress provided economic benefits as a quid pro quo, to those borrowers who wished to exit the program. In this case, the plaintiffs, the two at issue here, attempted to prepay their loan, and the FMHA said, under the restrictions, under the current statutory scheme, you can't prepay, but we can offer you these incentives. Under a completely separate loan agreement, we can offer you even lower interest loans and additional funds. This was not a charade, this was a carefully enacted statutory scheme.
But did the statute on its face require tender of prepayment under the original loan prior to the ability to take out the incentive loan?
What the statute says is that if a borrower offers to prepay, the agency should counter with incentive contracts. So a prerequisite for obtaining incentive contracts is an offer to prepay.
Now, but wasn't it written in, it was language written in terms of sort of like encouragement and that, but it wasn't, was it a requirement that there be a prior tender and a rejection before the incentive loan program could be used?
Yes.
And if you made a loan to someone who had not tendered, that would be an unlawful loan.
The incentive loans are only available to borrowers who attempt to prepay. Now, the Supreme Court, to go into the word tender, which has become common this summer.
You and Judge Ware may not be exactly the case of community. As I understood his question, he was asking whether the statute required an offer to tender. And what I understand your answer to say is the agency is not authorized to offer the incentive unless a tender has first been made.
I think the
so the effect is the same, but it's not literally a requirement in the statute. It's a matter of authorization from the Congress to the agency.
There is an authorization of the Congress to the agency to provide to offer the incentive arrangements to borrowers who want to prepay or
so
attempt
to prepay.
So in
effect, it becomes a requirement that they send in this letter if they want to get an incentive follow-on loan.
Yes, which is why it isn't a charade. These incentive agreements were not available to all borrowers, only to those who wanted to prepay, tried to prepay, and wished to exit the program. So it wasn't just a charade, it was a quid pro quo. So to compensate those who wished to exit the program but were required by the statute to stay in the program.
But how about the letter by the government officials? It didn't seem to have language that said, we reject your tender, we won't let you prepay, no way. There isn't any language like that in there that I can readily discern.
Well, let me address the language issues that we talked about earlier. First of all, while the Supreme Court does use the word tender, it uses the phrase that it uses most often is that the government must honor its obligation to accept an offer of prepayment. And what the Supreme Court said would be a breach was the failure to honor the government's obligation to accept an offer of prepayment. That was the holding of the case, and that holding did not use the word tender. In footnote 8 of the Supreme Court's decision, the Supreme Court noted that at least one petitioner has attempted to prepay, and that one petitioner apparently did not make a tender in the sense or enclose a check, or the Supreme Court did not note that fact in its footnote where it noted that there was one petitioner that has attempted to prepay. So too, the petitioners here send an unqualified, unequivocal letter saying that they wanted to prepay their entire remaining mortgage.
And we have to find that to be at least an offer to prepay.
Yes, or an attempt to prepay. And I think it does satisfy that requirement. Now, with respect to the government's response, the government did not expressly reject the offer. However, it counteroffered, which is, in a sense, a rejection of an offer. A counteroffer is certainly never considered an acceptance of an offer. And what the government did was to counteroffer with the incentive payment. So it clearly did not accept. The plaintiffs waited over 13 years.
Let me ask you where things stood at that moment. The letter, at least the first letter, says something like, this offer, the government's counteroffer, as you're calling it, is good for 30 days. Doesn't that mean that if the company never responded, that the counteroffer would go away, the offer to pay would stand or be revived, and then what would happen?
Well, we don't know because the plaintiffs took advantage of the incentive agreements. But certainly the government waited and never honored its obligation to accept repayment over a 13-year period before the plaintiffs filed suit. So if there was an obligation on the government's part, as the Supreme Court has held, to accept the prepayment, waiting 13 years certainly was not honoring an obligation to accept prepayment.
But this isn't a latches case, right? You're not depending on latches. You're depending on the six-year statute of limitation.
That's correct. But the plaintiffs waited for 13 years before filing suit. So by any common sense measure of an obligation to honor under a contract, honor an obligation under a contract, the government did not honor its obligation for a 13-year period, assuming that that offer remained present. And from the government's perspective, the plaintiff's offer was extinguished when they accepted the incentive contracts, because that was in the place of the prepayment obligation.
Was the incentive contract then conditioned on withdrawing your offer of prepayment?
I don't believe it was expressly conditioned.
And the government took some, at least in one case, almost 3 years before it offered the incentive. In other words, there was a letter saying, I'd like to prepay, and several years go by, and the government says, we'd like to offer you this incentive. What was the state of the contract between the parties during the period of time before the government responded?
The original contract remained in effect. I thought it was only 1 year, but assuming it was several years, the original contract remained in effect.
I thought the first letter was 1988, and the contract itself was 1991.
Okay, I thought that was the 91 contract was in response to the 1990 letter, but I'll accept your version of the facts. The contracts remained in effect during that time. But certainly during that three-year period, the government was not honoring its obligation to accept prepayment.
What happens to the prepayment right after the government refuses to allow prepayment? Is it extinguished from the contract?
No, under the Supreme Court's decision, the borrower can sue the United States for breach.
Right, but if you don't and the contract continues, what happens to that right? That's why I'm... If you have an ongoing contract and you offer to perform on a particular clause of the contract and the other side doesn't take you up on it, but the contract continues, is there a legal principle that says that clause is now extinguished from the contract if you don't file a lawsuit?
Well, there are certainly principles of waiver that could come into effect on if we got past the statute of limitations issue. But in this case, the plaintiffs waited 13 years and 10 years after the filing of the seminal case in Franconia, which put the entire industry on notice that these claims might be filed against the government.
So I would have to find an intentional relinquishment by the property owners here of their right to file a lawsuit after 6 years. Yeah, they have the right for the 6 year period of time. After that, they would relinquish their rights. I'd have to find some intentional conduct after that on their part to say, I can no longer prepay because I've given up that right under the contract.
Well, I would view it differently, Your Honor. Under the Supreme Court's decision in Franconia, after 6 years, their claim would be barred by the statute of limitations.
The claim on that prepayment, which would be a different amount of money than later on. If I tender prepayment after year two of the contract, and that's refused, wrongfully, but refused, and I don't file a lawsuit, what is it to say I can't, in the 12th year of the contract, say, hey, I'd like to prepay. It's a different amount of money now. And if they refuse that one, file yet a lawsuit within 6 years of that refusal. What takes the right of prepayment out of this contract? The contract doesn't provide a one-time right of prepayment. It's a right to prepay at any time.
Well, I don't believe that any plaintiff in this situation has attempted to prepay more than twice. And these petitioners did not attempt to prepay more than twice. The second agreement, which they tried to characterize as an extension of the original agreement, is a separate agreement, and it does not contain any right of prepayment.
So we should be careful not to say in any opinion that we issue that having the statute of limitations run on the right of prepayment as to a particular tender extinguishes the right to tender in the future, because these are contracts that still have years to run.
I would have to go back and look at the contract again to make sure that there's not some other clause that restricts the right to prepayment. So that you could only, I don't know that you can make an offer of prepayment more than once under these contracts. But here there was, because they accepted the incentive contract, if we got past the statute of limitations point, the government might argue, and we haven't gotten to that point yet because the trial court held that this case was time barred, but the government might argue that, for example, there was an accord and satisfaction when they accepted the incentive contract.
But it wasn't a wraparound. The original contract remains. The incentive contract is a separate contract with its own provisions, its own terms, and it actually ends prior to the end of the original contract.
That's correct, but the incentive contract was only made available to the plaintiffs because they attempted to prepay. And the government declined to accept the offer to prepay and instead offered them the incentive contract. Very attractive provisions. So if we got beyond the statute of limitations, it's possible that the government would argue that there had been an accord and satisfaction over that prepayment right. With regard to the trial court's decision not to allow an amendment of the complaint, the trial court did not foreclose the possibility of the plaintiffs filing a new complaint should there ever be a breach of the incentive agreement. The incentive agreement did not contain any right to prepayment, and the trial court held that there had been no breach of that separate incentive agreement, and therefore it would be futile to amend the complaint to allow a new claim.
How could it be breached if the government's already turned over the money and there is no other performance for the government to render? Then it's hard to see how they could possibly breach it.
Well, that's our point, Your Honor. I believe the plaintiffs argued that there could be a future breach, but if there is a future breach, then, of course, they could file a future complaint. But we respectfully submit that it was not an abuse of discretion for the trial court to deny the plaintiff's request to amend their complaint to add an additional claim of a breach of the incentive agreement. For those reasons, as well as those set forth in our complaint, we respectfully ask that the court affirm the judgment below.
All right, thank you, Mr. Feedback. I'll give you the 3 minutes you saw tonight for rebuttal.
Your Honor, with respect to the issue of what was intended under this incentive loan program, at pages A384 and 385 of the appendix, we have a document that was produced by the government. Guidelines for accepting prepayment in order to ensure tenant protections. And on page A385, The government says in its documents, in accordance with paragraph 4 of Exhibit E, every borrower who requests a prepay and can document the ability to prepay will be offered an incentive to not do so. The size of the incentive will be based on whether this housing is needed by current tenants and other low and moderate income people in the market area and on the loss of the borrower by remaining in the program. The size of the incentive loan, this is on page 8386, the size of the incentive loan may not be based on whether the borrower actually wishes to prepay or wishes to receive an incentive to not prepay, or on whether the borrower is a servicing borrower. So the government understood that some of these people writing these letters under this program may not have had any idea in the world that they wanted to prepay. And that's why we say there's a factual issue that at least we think on the basis of their documents, the government is wrong when they say this wasn't, maybe it wasn't a charade, but it was a preset dance that everybody knew what the music was, well, that you had to dance to.
What precisely is the factual issue requiring a trial?
Well, the fact issue would be whether or not the government understood that this letter was not really a request to prepay, not an intention to prepay the loan, but was really simply a necessary ingredient in order to get the incentive loan.
So what if the government did have that understanding? How does that change the operation of the statute of limitations?
Then, Your Honor, would not have been, this document, which we don't think is a tender to begin with, would not, as a matter of fact, have been an election to treat the repudiation as a breach and start the running of the statute of limitations. Because as Judge Ware said, they didn't have to demand prepayment at that time. They could have demanded prepayment any place along the line over the life of the loan. I also think the government has misstated the Supreme Court's holding in Franconia. The court said at the beginning of its analysis, accordingly, breach would occur and the six-year limitations period would commence to run when a borrower tenders prepayment and the government tenders prepayment and the government then dishonors its obligation to accept the tender. Excuse me, releases control over use of the property that secured the loan. And at the very end of the court's opinion, Justice Ginsburg repeats the holding, concluding that each petitioner's claim is timely filed if, within 6 years of a wrongly rejected tender of prepayment, and she goes on to reverse the evidence, and four times within the context of the beginning and end of the opinion, there's analysis under the issue of tender, not on some other standard. With regard to
your view is there's never been a rejection of
correct
any offer to prepay.
Correct. Yes,
Your Honor. Therefore, there isn't yet a breach.
That's correct. Under Francona, the election would be the beginning to bring the suit.
Yeah, that's the position.
But that's under the repudiation theory.
Yes.
But
yes.
Not under a breach theory.
Yes.
Why hasn't there been a subsequent tender?
Well, we're waiting to see what happens with this case. We think that we should proceed, and we haven't done anything inappropriate here. Your Honor's asked about the amendment issue. At page A121 of the appendix, the judge was questioning Mr. William on this issue of whether or not we had pleaded properly the incentive loan issue, and the court says, what if plaintiff wanted to amend his complaint to make clear that he was suing on the basis of the expiration of the period of the restrictions and elected to sue prematurely, which is what is being allowed, or is allowed under Franconia? I don't know what your problem would be. And the government did not oppose the idea of amendment. The problem is that then we won on the opinion that issued after that argument. We were the prevailing party, we had no need to amend. Finally, Your Honor, on the issue that the government argued about accord and satisfaction if you went on the merits, Judge Miller rejected that defense in the what I'll call the Caroline 4 argument. That was the other group of plaintiffs that were not dismissed on the statute of limitations. And that's 81 federal claims, 752, 2008. She rejected and allowed all of those claims to go forward, notwithstanding that Tamerlane, the lead plaintiff, had accepted an incentive loan. But in that case, the lawsuit was started within 6 years, so we didn't have a statute of limitations.
All right, pleasure to see you both. Thank you so much. We'll take that case under advisement.
All rise. The Honorable Court is adjourned.